And then I'll finish up with, this is the macro project. This is a prose book called Cafe Multiple, and it's about poetry, being a poet. But I also hope that when it's finished, it'll have the feel of a genre of book that used to be called an anatomy. Anatomy is something that claims to be about one thing, but ends up being about everything under the sun. Although this section I'm reading is about poetry and growing up toward poetry. And it starts with the irresistible Joe Brainard invention. I remember the Book of Riddles. I remember the Dunlop Encyclopedia of Facts. I remember not being able to put the felt thing on the board and have it come out five. I remember a bat stuck to my screen window. I remember being audience to David, introduced below, as he read a sheaf of poems in my room, and my mother came into the room with cookies and coffee on a tray, a very unusual thing for her to do. We felt like princes. I remember digging my alleyway, especially coming down it from the Poplar Street end, so the view widened as you descended of people's tiny backyards and rickety wooden garages that no one put their cars in, and the orange flames making small flapping sounds from the oil drums everyone used for burning their garbage. There was no sky information. Everything was squat and close to the ground. I remember making a Heathkit radio set. It was a starter model, just tubes, diodes, and a masonite board with holes drilled into it at certain places. I wasn't sure I had one of the diodes attached to the right wire, but when I was finished and started turning the rheostat, the airwaves flowed through my earplug, a station in St. Louis, 80 miles away, broadcasting "The Night Has a Thousand Eyes." I remember talking poetry with David that went way past dinner time. On the way home, I picked wildflowers in the dark, an experiment to see what the bouquet would look like when I could see it. My mother was livid when I got home, missing dinner and that. Eyeing the flowers, she said, "At least you brought something." I remember when we moved, we had an auction. The auctioneer was in overalls and had the palaver down. One of the items was my first guitar. I'd gotten it selling light bulbs. In this coal mining town, that was the kind of school sales project. It had tiger stripes all over it, a glued-on brand label, Prestige, and a quarter-inch action. After learning on that, other guitars were easy. It was a piece of shit. I was heartbroken to see it go. I remember the first time I was made aware of Allen Ginsberg. It was in the most ridiculous way. I, EYE, a glossy faux counterculture magazine, ran a piece consisting of recipes from literary celebrities, or maybe it was just hip people in general. It was all made up, a humorous piece, I guess you'd call it. One of the offerings was something called Ginsburgers, and indeed provided the recipe for a kind of hamburger. There was an illustration of a shaggy-looking man in a Russian peasant coat done up in a classic Milton Glaser-ish 60s style, and the recipe itself was supposed to sound like one of the shaggy man's poems. I remember being invited to dinner at a friend's home and finagling his mother to make Ginsburgers. I brought the magazine over and showed her the recipe. Strangely enough, it made for a merry dinner table. My friend's older sister said it was hard to judge her Ginsburger because, quote, "there are all these different flavors going on around in my mouth." Years later, I realized she was saying she hated it. Looking back, I'm struck by how accommodating some of my friends' parents could be. They were often quite a bit younger than my own parents, so maybe that had something to do with it. Or maybe they sensed the the nascent gay comptroller lurking in that tiny seventh grader and decided they'd better go along. I remember the following week I saw a copy of Kaddish, and A was fascinated by the look of the book, so stark and small, unlike no book I'd ever seen before, and B saw that his lines were winding, unlike the I thing, which was staccato and abbreviated, more like a Gary Snyder poem, and C realized that he was expressing desires and releases that I vaguely understood were at home in me, that these longings had, in a strange kind of book, been rehearsed. I remember as a moving away gift, David gave me four books, Pound's Selected Poems, Beckett's Watt, Rambo's A Season in Hell, and I can't remember the fourth. I remember my first encounter with the New American Poetry 1945 to 1960. It was in David's room. David being David Gross, my oldest friend and college freshman to my high school junior. David was one of six kids with widely differing ages. The smaller ones shared rooms, and older ones usually ended up with small rooms to themselves as the even older ones left home. David's room was very small, enough space for a bed and a chest of drawers. His father was a miner, like many kids' miners. David's father, a lifelong pit miner, had survived a cave-in which broke his back. I don't remember seeing him very much. My own father went underground from time to time, but only to check on things. He sold explosives to the mines, both the old line underground ones and the more recent strip mines. He worked for a man who had developed uses for ammonium nitrate, mainly blasting and fertilizer, a kind of chemical Shiva. The blasting product was called airmite. Even though my brother and twin sisters became miners later on, my father's salary job as a salesman nudged us ever so slightly out of working class. In fact, I grew up in a relatively soft environment, and on top of that was a complete sissy who would hide under the bed when jock friends came to get me to sign up for Little League. Not even jock friends, I mean just friends came to get me to sign up for Little League. The space between the linoleum and the box springs was also very accommodating whenever my father wanted me to go fishing with him. It was bad enough to hold worms in your hand and try to work them onto a hook as their segments expanded and contracted in an effort to thwart the hook and singe your nerves. But it was even worse to try to get a northern pike off your hook, something you weren't even fishing for, as it flapped and writhed in your grasp and even tried to zip open a gash in your palm with a cold fin, a weapon from another world. A fishing expedition could be managed, but the actual sport was my introduction to trauma. Even so, my manliest scar to date is a crescent at the bottom of my left palm from slipping while running in the rain with a Rapala lure in my hand. I'd been writing poems forever, and I'd read thrillingly some Eliot and Stevens by this time. It was through David, though, that a more recent world was seen to be. Creeley, Olson, Wieners, O'Hara. We pored over their books as David successively checked them out of the college library. We read the poems aloud. We wondered what each poet was up to. And we were never uninterested in what these people actually looked like. Each seemed his own strange archetype. Sometimes we'd drive the 20 miles to Carbondale, even the names of towns spelled coal country, and the state university where he was enrolled. We'd go to the student union bookstore and look over the new poetry section, which wasn't half bad. Almost everything worth a second look seemed to be from New Directions. In fact, New Directions skewed my sense of publishing houses for years to come. The sheer breadth of its offerings and the modest look of the books themselves made me think the whole operation came out of some government printing office, a public service This surely couldn't be the result of one man's vision, could it? There was also Grove and City Lights and Evergreen and Kayak. Our own Mimeo magazine, Paper Dirt, lasted 2 majestic issues. The New American Poetry, with its white cover and red flag stripes, had been out for almost 10 years when David and I became aware of it. It took a while to get that it was 10 years old. A lot of the books that David had gotten from the library, The Charm, Meditations in an Emergency, Nerves, The Backcountry, were not books which had been called to produce the anthology, but were actually closer in time to the present. One or two poets had some publishing history behind them, but most had very little. Donald Allen had done something pretty interesting. He'd kept his ear to the ground and his intuition open, and had produced a collection of writers who had offered a near-complete counter-narrative to the Eastern Seaboard Anglophile poetry establishment as it was then constituted. And then there's a section here about the hegemony of Eliot, which is kind of boring. So going back to the anthology, one branch, the New York Poets, had been nurtured by Wallace Stevens. Other and more branches showed the influence of William Carlos Williams and, most decisively, of Ezra Pound. These two seemed the residing elder spirits of the anthology, the poets whose example provided a multitude of doors for others to enter through. And not in order to have careers under their shadow, but to find out where the ground was for each particular practice and to work forward from it. To find such a way was to be on the case, to carry the propositions that revealed themselves to new points of contact. In spite of the importance of Williams and Pound in this process, the pattern of their influence, one that dispersed rather than corralled, meant that they didn't function as predecessor poets in the linear way that Eliot had seemed to. Instead, this particular trunk seemed inhabited by the specter and the spectrum of post-war American life experience, patched together, transitive, far from parent. A hunger for experience is a cliche often heard in this vicinity, but I would add a hunger for literature, a native literature that would come into its own almost helplessly, and which as yet had but the slenderest American roots. The real outrage of the New American Poetry, which few at the time seemed to be able to put their finger on, was its attempt to establish in the U.S. something which had strong legacies elsewhere, the attempt to wean literature away from the literary and toward an open-air, high-low marriage of everything. As the years passed since David and I discovered this anthology, a good handful of the poets stayed the course with remarkable intensity. I would single out Larry Eigner, nominalist and essentialist at once. His Cloud, a single note line, may appear to stand as all clouds, but it's interacting in a carefully judged constellation of other particles that somehow orbit around one another, actions, thing nouns, speculations on history and the historical present, and so creates an entrance of cloud that is new to experience. This isn't someone looking out the window. This is someone thinking hard about how the world embodies itself. Anyone who thinks these poems are casual riffs, casually put down, should look at one of his letters to an editor or publisher, and his precise corrections of typos, but far more frequently, adjustments of N and M spaces. His workspace consists of planks surrounding the walls, set low to accommodate the height of his wheelchair. The planks held a large brick about every foot and a half, and the spaces between the bricks were jammed with single typewritten sheets, They made a white fringe around the room, a restless sculpture. Poems, poems, poems. Philip Whalen, a.k.a. the Holy Goof, later on Philip Zinschen, and perhaps the most authentically itinerant of the New Americans. His determination to write meant high-wire living conditions, staying in the available rooms of friends. No one wore his erudition more lightly. No one made mind as matrix more choreographic. Terms such as mind transmission or graphing the mind don't say it quite right. They miss his fourth dimension, his metaphysical space. No one understood the sanity of humor better. The many references in his work to poverty and hungry are grumpy rather than doleful. Even in his last days, the systems shutting down one by one, he declared that he wanted his body laid out on a bed of frozen raspberries. His major surgery for endocarditis, which involved shutting down the heart and essentially freezing the patient, he described as, quote, a very interesting experience. He was wise to his friends, demanding of his students, and, as my friend Marilyn can attest, a willing meditation instructor to a stranger knocking at his door. His doodles are great, like noting else. I meant to type nothing but the other works. He wrote two fantastically beautiful everyday novels. John Wiener's poems in the anthology are poems for others, a poem for trapped things, a poem for the old man, for example. They are offerings, votives. They are rites of literature from a soul half in love with its abjections. Like Andy Warhol, Wiener's was a fucked up Catholic, but the differences between them are more telling than the similarities. Warhol denied the body in order to control his environment, putting his infatuations in casts of irony that deflected hurt, but also touch. Wiener's didn't deny himself like this. He kept himself gentle, a practice, a state of being, which allowed hurt, but also the chance of grace. His kind of being open was both simple and deep, a form of painstaking. It may explain the edge of laceration in the poetry. But nothing is needed to make a context for his lyric gift, the purest and most direct of anyone of his generation. In a few decades, his poetry would become solidly and elementally strange, a kind of listening to print that simultaneously lurched forward and stayed in place. On occasion, he'd said that he no longer wanted to be the tortured lyricist. The late work may or may not have been the result of decades of drug use. It may have been what he meant when he declared that he was living out the implications of his books. Visitors to his apartment in later years may have been greeted by their host in drag. They would have noticed the large number of bookshelves, which were, however, empty of books. This gentlest of poets never lost his power to confound or his queer intransigence. Robert Creeley's continual evolution as a poet throughout his 80 years. From the halting articulations of For Love, using William's energetic line as a wounded and nervous one, to the acid minimalism of Pieces and Hello and all the small Black Sparrow books in between, and finally to an extended domestic life and the achievement of a modest and hard-won vantage point, still with plenty of edge in the poetry. His last full-length book used stark rhyme without a trace of sentimentality. Throughout the journey, he wants to unfold the human implications in everything that has stayed tenacious. His engagement with new poetry and poets went beyond reading. It took the form of volunteerist labors, matched only perhaps by his beloved Williams, welcoming, encouragement, mentoring, intense exchange, blurbs, and as often as not, lasting friendship. For any poet of any age doing interesting work, he was that poet's contemporary. When someone in the community died, it was always to him that one looked, to say the words that would make sense, to place the writer in the most meaningful space on the continuum. A lot of words were said when he died, but not the ones we wanted to hear. They weren't his. My father and he lived to the same age. Both of their deaths were abrupt, impossible to assimilate. The romantic tone of the above encapsulations should not disguise the hard lives these people led. They didn't accommodate their calling to an economic baseline. They toughed it out instead. I admire hundreds of poets for hundreds of reasons. These poets and some others are to this day my model for commitment in the face of long and indifferent odds. Each held onto the demon tree with both hands. That's it. Thank you.